day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Copernik Global Investors second quarter 2019 conference call. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. At the conclusion of today's presentation, there will be a question and answer session. Instructions will be given at that time. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to Qasim Ghaffar. Please go ahead, Mr. Ghaffar.
Thank you, operator. Hello and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today for the second quarter 2019 conference call. My name is Qasim Ghaffar, and I have with me David Ibin, our CIO and lead portfolio manager for the Copernik Global All Cap Strategy and co-PM for the International Strategy. Before I pass the call over to Dave for the bulk of the call, I'd like to give everyone a quick firm update. From an overall AUM standpoint, the firm assets at the end of the quarter were right around $4.1 billion versus $3.4 billion at the end of 2018. We're currently at peak assets at the eve of our six-year anniversary and very pleased with the confidence our clients have entrusted with us. In addition to positive market action, we saw roughly net new asset growth of more than $300 million during the first half of the year. Although the last couple of years have not been conducive to value as the start of investing and to active managers, we believe our clients have been pleased with our discipline to not give in to the temptation of chasing the high-flying momentum stocks of today. This clearly helped us in years like 2016, the fourth quarter of 2018, and the most recent sell-off in May, although short-lived, when our portfolios performed well and our clients have been benefited by the consistency and the diversification that our portfolio provides. Lastly, as a firm, I would like to add that we are 38 people strong and have been stable with no turnover in staff. Please note, Dave will be referring to the presentation, which can be found on our website at copernikglobal.com under the News and View section. And with that, I'll pass it over to Dave. Dave?
Okay. Thanks, Qasim, and thanks to everybody for joining the call. Seems like every quarter gets more interesting than the quarter before. Certainly, this year is no exception. When it comes to market overview, we've always been a fan of Grant's Interest Rate Observer and their comments and their sense of humor, and I think nothing captures the current environment better than this comic here. It's interesting to hear so many people go risk on. For us, we've never quite understood the concept of investing people's retirement funds on a risk-on mentality. But now more than ever, this year has been fascinating because the worse the economy gets, the more people want to be risk-on. And so we've had a barrage of bad economic news. It seems pretty clear things are getting tougher. And with each bit of bad news, people say risk-on. I think probably correctly perceiving that the Federal Reserve will print however much money they need to, and having failed to exit the last bound of money printing, it's clear more money printing is on the way. So I guess it's understandable that stocks are going up, although not so understandable why the stocks of money-losing companies are doing better than the ones of good, profitable companies. And certainly makes sense that gold is at a more than six-year high today. So the money seems to be on the way. More on this environment, I guess it doesn't matter if the economy is getting weaker. Fundamentals don't seem to matter a whole lot to people. And speaking of risk, what could be more risky than investing without doing any due diligence or analysis? And maybe many of you have seen this recent article from J.P. Morgan suggesting that 80% of money is now on, or stock market money is now on autopilot, in their words. Interesting timing, our recent commentary, the Renaissance and the Entropic Arrow of Time, talked about how in this time where theoretically analysis has never been easy, we have more access to data, more access to systems, more ability to crunch numbers. You think there will be more analysis going on, and how interesting that people are choosing now not to think for themselves. And this, we believe, is good news. This is music to the ears of fundamental-based investors. the less analysis going on, the higher the degree of market inefficiency. And that's, of course, what active managers hope to exploit. Now, risk is one thing. Maybe even more absurd than the risk of possibly losing money is guaranteed loss. And that's what many people are seeking now. Matter of fact, there's $13.5 trillion, that's trillion with a T, that's invested in bonds with negative interest rates. In other words, you buy these bonds and hold them to maturity, you're guaranteed to lose money. Fascinating time. But people want clarity. Seems like they would rather lose 60 basis points with certainty on the Swiss bond than buy something else where people do not know when the returns are going to come in. Now, there's a couple problems with this. One is the price they're paying. But before we get to that, let's talk about the idea of the certainty they're paying for. Problem with perceived certainty is it does not equal certainty. People think they know the future. They do not know the future. This little slide here shows the U.S. 10-year bond yesterday with its yield of a little more than 2%. And next to it is yields where they were when I came into the business. This is my lifetime in the United States, so we're not talking real bad things. We're talking they were 15% on the 10-year bond. If rates went back to that, we're not suggesting that's going to happen, that would result in a 65% loss. The 30-year bond would be more like an 85% loss, and I haven't even bothered to calculate the loss if some of these negative yielding things go to 15%. So people better be right that rates stay negative forever, because if printing money causes inflation, as history and logic would suggest, it's possible that this certainty turns out actually to be a disaster. More on the idea that people shouldn't feel certain about the future. Here's a list of technology. These were all big things. These were things that were going to be the future. They were going to grow fast forever. Many of them are from the last couple decades. People were excited about these things. Now they've gone from the future to relics of the past, and it happens pretty quickly. We also talked in the recent commentary about how people love tech because it's disrupting things, and that's true. There's going to be a lot of big winners in tech, and it is exciting, but technology is not the one where only the one where disruptors come from. Many, many, many disruptees are in technology. I think probably no industry gets more disrupted than technology. You can see on here, I think, the times the markets look like it does now were 1972 and 1999. In 1972, people were willing to pay a fortune for Polaroid cameras, which are on here. 99, many of the things on here were considered pretty exciting, usually a mistake. A little more on whether we ought to be certain about the future. The debt as a percent of GDP is now over 100% in the U.S. That, the vast majority of the time, causes problems in the future. It's worse than Japan and parts of Europe. So a debt can work both ways. Things might turn out good, but quite certainly that debt will not be helpful if the economy turns down. Certainty on the future, insiders, they're certainly not feeling very good about the futures. Very high levels of insider selling. So a lot of reasons why people shouldn't think they know the future. And then even if they do know the future, now let's turn to the positive part of this presentation. Where people are paying a lot for their false perceptions of certainty, they're giving away assets that don't come with such false promises. This chart shows people can be pretty certain that you're going to get paid what you were promised on a sovereign bond, and hence a mere 2% in the U.S., but negative in many countries is on a 10-year basis. Fascinating. Investment grade bonds, of course, are a step away from sovereign. A lot of them are pretty high quality. Then maybe you get a little more yield, but an increasing number of investment grade bonds are now guaranteed losses. Then as you get a little step further away, you can get to high yield bonds and quality growth stocks. Quality growth stocks, you're quite likely to do pretty well in terms of getting nice cash flows year after year in the future. Probably a little less than people expect, but even if it's not a little less, these things are priced to make sure that you get a pretty low return on average over the next decade, or history and logic have shown that paying high prices gets you low returns. Once you get outside the U.S., prices are a little better priced, and so you can get better returns, but those markets are near all-time highs, too. But once you start to step away and get a little more uncertainty, once you get into the emerging markets, which are more famous for their volatility, there you're getting companies that are probably faster growing and many times strong concentration and good cash flows. But people aren't certain about which day the headlines will be good and which day they won't. When the economy does well and doesn't. And so since they're not certain, instead of giving you a 1 or 2% earned yield, they will give you a 20, 30% earned yield in many cases for good companies. Now it starts to get pretty interesting. Beyond that, scarce assets, assets that cannot be replaced easily, things that aren't going to go obsolete, you know, who knows what the technology world will offer 10 years from now, but we could be pretty certain that people are still going to use electricity, and they're still going to eat food, and they're still going to want copper, and they'll probably want some gold as a protection of purchasing power. So here you've got stuff that actually is less risky in terms of losing value over time, but there's no certainty. These things famously get too expensive and too cheap and too expensive and too cheap, and sometimes they stay cheap for a long time. Because people don't like that, we are able to own farmland and uranium mines and oil wells and gold mines and tankers and hydroelectric generation assets and so on and so forth for half of what they're worth, sometimes a third of what they're worth, a quarter of what they're worth, suggesting we could make two or three or four times our money, but we don't know when. When I came into business, if you were wrong by a couple of years on the stock, you were missing out on the chance to make 22% a year on a money market fund. Now you're missing out on zero, more roughly zero, negative on some bonds that we mentioned. And if you have to wait, maybe things are looking like we won't have to wait too long, but if we have to wait, we've made a habit of showing you all this chart because we think it's very, very important. If you can buy things at half price, it is worth the wait. We hope they double this year. But if it takes 2 years, 41%, if it takes 5 years, we're making 15% a year. Yeah. 7 year wait would be double digit returns. So this is an environment that doesn't have a lot of interest rates. So, we believe that buying assets that have long run sustainable value is a very good thing to do. Now, I guess in the Q&A we can go over some of the specifics, although I've told you guys a lot of other things ad nauseum, so we won't go into a lot more. We will show this chart. While gold is at a 6-year high, commodities are not. This is commodities relative to the S&P. You can see how they went from pretty expensive a dozen years ago to the cheapest ever right now, and hence that's given us the opportunity to increase positions in natural gas and uranium and those sort of things. So really a fascinating environment. And that is all very, very attractive, even if the Fed's plan to start printing money again do not cause inflation. Not necessary for these things to work. this bifurcation in this market, this willingness to give away unpopular stuff, has allowed us to build a portfolio that's two-thirds of tangible book value, one times sales, it's, you know, less than five times gross cash flow. Very interesting. And on the concept of risk, the volatility, as we've also mentioned to people, is commonly mistaken to be risk. Of course, might be risk to people's comfort zone or their businesses, but it is not at all related to risk of the portfolio. And counterintuitively, actually, volatility has led to lower risk. If you believe that risk is most value managers do, and as Howard Marks and others will point out, that risk is about the possibility of permanent loss of capital, and the cheaper you can buy something, the less risky it is. Yeah. He points out that bonds that are on default are low risk if you're buying them at 10 cents on the dollar. So because people are selling the stuff that's more volatile, that means their prices are cheaper, their valuations are cheaper, which actually makes them less risky. So that's point one. We actually have a lower risk by portfolio by having some risky stocks in there. And then secondly, of course, it should be obvious to people the chance to buy low and trim high is a positive thing. And so that's what we've been doing over the years. That's what's helped us tread water in a market that's been hostile to those value names. We've tread water because there are times like 2015, we bought the smaller mining, and 2016, we sold them and bought the bigger ones. And last year, we were able to buy the smaller ones again, which thankfully are doing pretty well now. And we've seen people hate Russia, and we were able to put a lot there when they just, you know, Russia had a really good couple of years. We were able to trim that and now buy more of Korea, things like that. And when people didn't like oil back 3 years ago, we were able to buy oil companies. Now they like oil okay. They hate natural gas, and that's given us opportunities. And so as we see on this page, that's continued to be the case. The idea that we get paid to wait, Gazprom sat there and went nowhere for 5 years. We collected our 6% dividend, but this year it went up 70-some-odd percent. It was worth the wait. So we've trimmed that. We still like it, but we were able to trim that and move into Crescent Point. People don't like Canada now. It's a fascinating thing. Our pipeline problems and whatnot. So that's opportunity. You know, I mentioned large versus small. It was a long wait for Impala. That moved up. Newcrest has been a good one for a lot of years. So we've trimmed those and been able to add to InnovaGold and Folius and Seabridge, which we've waited patiently for chances to buy more of them at cheap prices. And General Electric was something that had gone from $60 to $6 and something, and over the years, and we bought that, but we were able to trim a lot of that at 10, 11, and move that into to things like Korea Electric Power. So we were able, in say real estate, to sell, you know, finance, so mostly East Europe, that's done pretty well recently, and roll that into LSR, which is real estate in Russia. And so on and so forth. Japan West is another one. We were able to buy that years ago after the earthquake in Japan, priced the railroads very, very cheaply, and they've gone up and up and up. They're still pretty interesting, but a lot closer to what they're worth. And so we've sold our railroad transportation and rolled into more Stolt-Nielsen, which is a specialty shipper company. And so yeah, I could go on, but the point is volatility is not a bad thing. It's actually a very, very good thing. Similar stuff in the international is with the global, and same concepts. And just to quickly go through this portfolio, it's we showed you the valuations. It's a deep value valuations, but it's not a deep value portfolio. One, it's in the growing parts of the world. You see the emerging markets being high 30s in terms of percentage of the portfolio. That's a beautiful thing to get growth at a value price. And and hit the upper right, as we will continue to point out, these are not, you know, number seven in their industry turnaround situations. This is a portfolio of market leaders. See the first and second largest uranium producers in the world, the third largest gold producer, the largest gas producer, the largest hydro generator, the second largest hydro generator, the largest nuclear electricity generator, the first and second largest trading companies. So really interesting time to be an investor. I think an excellent time to be an active manager and an excellent time to be a value manager. And as we pointed out with the IRR, the bargains are so good that, you know, we hope we don't have to wait too long, but if we have to wait, the opportunities are worth the wait. So with that, let me open it for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. We'll take our first question from Lance Hollingsworth.
Good afternoon. Any comments on the Cameco news and Trump's talk about uranium quotas?
Certainly. Thank you. People, let's talk uranium and then narrow down into Cameco. You know, people always ask us for catalysts, and we generally don't have catalysts. Usually the stocks have moved by the time the catalysts are apparent. It's not the case with uranium. After a long, long wait, everything is going right for uranium, except the price hasn't moved yet. But if the price of being too high brings out supply, that was the case when uranium got too high at 137. The Kazakhs brought their production up 10 times. Cameco brought on supply, and of course, demand slowed down, and especially with Fukushima, 53 plants went offline. The price, once 137, got to 18. Fair price is between 60 and 90 somewhere, well, we're pretty sure. So two low prices are supposed to solve the problem, and they are. The catalysts are there. In the 20s, it's taking care of itself. The Kazakhs have cut production a few times. Cameco shut down the largest and best mine in the history of mankind, sent their employees home and said, we'll call you when the price doubles it. And so that was interesting. You've had the Department of Energy in the U.S. stop selling. The Russian government stopped selling a number of years ago. On the demand side, Japan's brought back 9 of their plants, and we'll bring back another 10 or 15 of them. China, we've talked for years about their developing. We finally have brought 6 plants on, and they've got 30-some-odd plants still on the way in the future. In addition, you've had funds set up just to buy uranium at these prices and hold them. We own a couple of them. More are coming on the way. So supply and demand are more than in balance. The huge, huge inventories from years ago are getting worked off. Eventually, you'll have billions and billions of dollars worth of reactors sitting idle unless the price of uranium goes high enough to stimulate demand. So the catalysts are there. Uranium looks really good. Outside of that, yes, there was some small U.S. miners who had got the government to consider that maybe there should be requirements that the U.S. produce its own uranium, which, of course, was impossible. The U.S. doesn't have anywhere near enough uranium to supply 25% of its needs, and if we really thought that it was a strategic need for the U.S., the U.S. can go on there and buy uranium and start stockpiling it. It's unbelievably cheap. So that was, I don't think, ever anything to do with that. It was some companies wanting to be able to sell uranium in the U.S. for many multiples of what it sells outside of the U.S. That would have been a hardship on the U.S. reactors. That fell through. And so that seemed to make the stocks go up one day, and they went back down the next day. So I guess the market, all said and done, didn't expect it to happen in the first place. And really, there's no way it feasibly could have happened. So, yeah, maybe it's non-news, but it would have been very disruptive to nuclear utilities if it had happened. So, no real comment on that other than it's been resolved and people can go back there about their lives. On terms of Cameco specifically, last summer they won a major award with the Canadian government. They were trying to get anywhere from $400 million to over $2 billion of taxes from Cameco. The court sided completely with Cameco, said you don't owe a single nickel. And that was a big victory, and that's appealed, and who knows, but once something's been completely won like that, it's probably not likely to be overturned. More recently, what appeared like maybe good news was actually very bad news. There was a Japanese company that had been fearful they were not going to have enough uranium when the prices were 110. They signed long-term contracts to buy at 110. The price plunged into the 20s, and they reneged on their contract. So it went into arbitration, and the court found the only thing they possibly could have found, you don't have the right to renege on that contract, Cameco wins. The contract was worth $1 billion or something. The court awarded Cameco $40 million. Where on the surface they won, they lost. And I think the stock viewed it that way too. It's really inconceivable how the court could say your contract was good, but we're not going to pay you for what it was worth. So that was bad news. But outside of that, you've got Cameco well positioned, as well as Kazatomprom and then some of the future companies, NextGen and Fission and those sort of things. And the catalysts are there. And that's even if the Fed doesn't come back and print a bunch of money. And so a lot going on in uranium, but most of it's pretty positive.
Okay, thank you.
We'll take our next question from Patricia Neubeller.
Hello, David.
Hello.
Interested in your thoughts about AI and robotics, and if you've had any opportunities to seize in terms of investing in that, and maybe drilling down into China, what you've been able to invest in there, if anything, and if they have anything interesting in terms of robotics as well.
Certainly. You know, robotics, I think, is just an evolution. You know, 30 years ago, people were starting to put robots in, say, car manufacturing. It's more with arms, and they get more sophisticated over time. And now, of course, with exponentially increasing abilities of computers and vision and sensors and those sort of things, robotics is certainly a growth business and keeps picking up steam. So it's very, very important. The last commentary I mentioned, we talked about disruption, and robotics is disrupting a lot of things, and 3D printing and things like that are disrupting a lot of things. So it does make it difficult for companies that have expensive plant and equipment to find that somebody else can buy a robot and a 3D printer and replicate what they have. It makes things more difficult. Rather than buy the AI providers or the robotic players, we do two things. One, we, as we point out in this commentary, the businesses that are most likely to be disrupted are, oddly enough, some of the more highly priced companies out there. And so that we've tended to avoid or want bigger discounts, and we tend to have a portfolio of things that are harder to disrupt. And so that's one thing. And then in terms of technology, whether it's robots or computers or biotechnology or you name it, there are venture cap companies that are good, and there's some companies that are good at identifying things. But our style has been, we'll let the 100 companies duke it out and see who the two or three or four companies are that win. And every now and then a 2000 or a 2008 comes along and we get to buy those companies at 80% off. We were in the 1980s able to buy Genentech and Hybridtech and some of those things had big discounts. In 2009, we were able to buy Microsoft and eBay and all those things at discounts. So, I don't think our competitive strength is being better than the other people with their hundreds of analysts is figuring out who's likely to win. Our strength is seeing who wins and buy them at a time when things look so bleak that people can't stomach buying them. And that will continue to be our approach. But it is really exciting times. Now, China, for the last 20 years, we've most of the time said, we're playing China without actually being in China. So they've got a lot of growth. We've done really well over the years owning companies that sell them food and sell them raw materials. That certainly worked really well a dozen years ago. And even further than that, we've had a lot of agricultural companies. We've tended to own companies that are based in Japan that sell into China, that sort of thing. So there's that. Then to actually go into China, and whether we're talking China or Brazil or Russia or you name it, we've always thought that people were right 10 years ago when they said the BRICS are really exciting and they're probably going to grow faster than the rest of the world and you really need to be there. And they were also right when they decided over the last 3 or 4 years that there's a lot of corruption and there's a lot of uncertainty and maybe they should be avoided. And so we look for a middle ground. We tended not to own these things when they were well loved. But as I said earlier in the presentation, once things become uncertain, that's the opportunity. So whether it's, say, Brazil and Russia a few years ago, which, of course, sell a lot into China, when people were very afraid of them a few years ago, we were able to get some bargains. And then China itself, we pick and choose. So over the last year, we were able to buy their two largest phone companies at very low multiples. So we've done that. We've owned the railroads. Someone was asking earlier about J.R. West, but when the railroads in the U.S. were cheap, we owned them. When they ran up, we bought the Japanese railroads. They've run up. Now we own the one from Hong Kong to Shenzhen. That seems pretty interesting to us. In the past, we've owned agriculture companies. We've owned other companies. So, We don't do top-down or predict the future, but it's quite possible that China's sort of like the U.S. was 90 years ago, i.e. a great future, but also quite likely to pay the price for the massive debt they've built up over the last dozen years. So we see probably a prosperous but very rocky road. And so I think most of you know, we never pay full price for anything. We want discounts for everything. We want bigger discounts as the uncertainty picks up, and we want huge discounts to be in China, Russia, Brazil, places like that. But we've been getting huge discounts from time to time, so we're certainly fans of many good companies that happen to be in China.
So So, Dave, I got to say, I love and very much appreciate your investment approach. It's music to my ears. And one follow-up question to China. What's your take on, I think it's called SDR, but the basket currency and the threat that that may be to the dollar and so on? And obviously China's a big player and all that.
Well, I guess we could go on for an hour. I promise everybody I won't. But money's a fascinating subject. You've got the cryptocurrencies, which have some really great aspects, and then they've got some uncertainties. And you've got gold, which is cumbersome and hard to store, not the best medium of exchange, but it's been a wonderful store of value for the last 6,000 years and undoubtedly will be going forward. And then there's fiat currencies. They're great mediums of exchange. They're much easier to, especially you can do it all electronically now for the most part. And so fiat currencies are great for that. However, history and logic proves that they lose their value pretty quickly. The U.S. dollar's lost 90-some-odd% of its purchasing power over my lifetime. The Federal Reserve has a goal to make the dollar lose 2% of its money every its value every year. Jim Grant's pointed out, and we've checked the math, and of course he's right. If you lose 2% a year in an average person's lifetime, prices go up 5 times. So that's the problem with fiat currencies. Now, SDR, you have one global currency, which of course is what gold was for a lot of years. And it did the job, but politicians were unable to print more gold. And that's why it sold its value. Now, the SDR, now you got a bunch of global politicians in charge of the money supply. There's advantages to SDRs, but there's a lot of disadvantages to SDRs. And so it all comes down to currencies that are managed by politicians versus gold, which is not managed by politicians. How much interest should somebody pay you to hold those fiat currencies? And I don't care whether it's a dollar or a euro or a yen or an SDR. When I came into the business, people said 22% is not enough to trust government politicians all on gold. Of course, it was the wrong choice. But whether it should be 5% or 10 or 15 or worthy discussions, zero is the wrong interest rate to hold any currency. And SDRs won't change that. So I think I'll leave it at that.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And as a reminder, please press star 1 to ask a question. We'll take our next question from Ron Price.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Hi, just any comments on Trump's election to his Trump's Fed picks who voiced a return to the gold standard? I guess that goes in line with what you had just talked about with SDRs, but maybe if you could elaborate on that further.
As far as, well, let's start with, we are not top down, and we, as far as what Trump or any other politician says, we don't factor that in at all. I will say historically, when Obama was president, we were able to buy healthcare stocks at a cheap price because people didn't like them. And when Lula won in Brazil years ago, we were able to buy cheap things there because people didn't like them. And 3-4 years ago, they still don't like Putin, but they hated him so much that we were able to buy things at 20% of book value. As far as whether Trump or any of the proposed Fed members who talk about gold now and then would go back to the gold standard, I doubt it. why would you when you can get away with printing money out of thin air and paying interest rates of next to nothing? So I doubt they will. If they did, the gold would have to skyrocket. The amount of dollars that are in circulation for every ounce of gold the U.S. has gone from 400 35 years ago to 13,000 now. So it'd certainly be very good for gold if that happens. But politicians don't willingly tether themselves to gold. They only do it when they have to. So we don't put any credence on that, but we would welcome it if it happens.
We'll take our next question from Dan Gallagher.
Hey, Dave. Hi, Dave. I'm wondering if you're still rolling puts in the portfolio and what your, you know, what the drag of that quote insurance is roughly for us.
Yeah, we certainly are. Our view is 70 positions in the portfolio, and we can buy something that's grossly undervalued. We will do that. Very few things I've seen in my life that are more undervalued than those. You know, a put that you say is kind of like a form of insurance. The more likely an accident happens, the more insurances work. Yeah. Insurance companies tend to raise their rates after the accident instead of before. I think the markets are the same way. Value of put options go up after a crash and they go down when you haven't had one for a long time, which of course is a mistake. The longer the market goes up without a bear market, the more likely the next bear market's severe or meaningful, the more likely it happens. Not only just length of time, but the length of time that the economy hasn't had a downturn is also at record, so that can't go on forever. And then valuations. On most metrics, this is the U.S. market is the most expensive in history. And so puts should be the most expensive ever. So if the implied vol has generally been 20, maybe it should be 30. Instead, it's 13. It got down to 8. Our view is we cannot predict when a correction comes, but we can predict that a correction will come. That's obvious. We just don't know when. So these things are so cheap that if a correction comes anytime in the first 3 or 4 years of doing it, we'll make pretty good money. Now, we've been doing this for 2.5 years, and there has been no downturn in the market that's lasted more than a month or so. And so, to your question, the drag has been 1% every 2 months. Not quite that bad because we made some money last year. So maybe it's been half of that instead of 6% a year. It's 3 or 4% a year. We will continue to do this until one or two things happens. The market drops and we'll take our gains and go. Or the market starts pricing these things correctly, in which case we'll feel that we don't have any edge and we will move on and go on to the next good investment.
And are these, you know, typically positioned on, you know, the S&P or the QQQs, and do you do these typically, you know, 10% out of the money or even further where you'd get bigger bang for the buck if there was a – are you agile in how you do this?
Yes and no. Yeah, we could do them anywhere in the world, but it's interesting. Since the U.S. is the most expensive market in the world, it should have the most expensive puts, but it has actually – the cheapest put, so that's why we're doing the U.S. And if we were trying to hedge, we wouldn't be doing the U.S. because we really don't have U.S. stocks in the portfolio. The few U.S. stocks we have in the portfolio don't look at all like the market. So this is not a hedge. This is taking advantage of mispricings in the market. in terms of where we're not active, we're not in there wheeling and dealing and going further in and out of the money. We generally have been doing at the money, sometimes a little bit out. You're right, we get a lot more bang for the buck if we go out of the money. But once you go far enough out of the money, then you need a pretty big drop in the market to not lose your money. And then in terms of covering it, if the market keeps going up, we tend to cover early and roll because we get a better strike price. If we had done a three-year put in the beginning, it would be so far out of the money right now, a big drop wouldn't even get us even, or a big, because we keep rolling at higher and higher prices now, a big drop now would work out very well for us. If the market is dropping, then we tend to not roll them out. We tend to hold them till closer to the maturity. And so that's been the strategy.
Thank you.
We'll take our next question from Dave Oscar.
David, would you talk a little bit about Range Resources and also your thoughts on coal?
Certainly. Range Resources is a conundrum. It's a big position for it. It's one where, yeah, maybe one of these days they'll come out with some bad news, but yeah, obviously they've fallen with the price of natural gas, and natural gas is, you know, all commodities are volatile. Natural gas tends to be one of the more volatile ones. You know, the advantages are pretty obvious. It's cheap. It's fairly clean, a lot cleaner than other hydrocarbons. Abundant in North America. It's good for peaking in electricity, certainly if electronic cars catch on and we need more electricity. We probably won't build a lot more base load in the U.S., so that's probably good for gas. It's a lot of reasons to like gas. The bad part of gas is you can't store very much of it, so you have to have infrastructure in place. And you've had a situation where one of the many problems with the malinvestment that central bank policy has caused, we saw the damage it did to coal, which we'll come back to, and iron and oil and you name it. It did real damage when it convinced people to drill a bunch of holes in the ground that, you know, did or didn't make a lot of economic sense. All the supply comes on, you need to have pipelines. There are places, we just came back from a trip to Alberta, Canada. People had to pay people to take their gas away. If there's no pipeline capacity, it's a problem. So that sort of accentuates how cheap gas can get and how expensive it can get. So it's been tough for gas companies relative to oil companies, and hence we've been buying the gas companies. Range, however, the stock was 90-something, dropped to 6. It's a company whose balance sheet's in better shape than a lot of their competitors are. It's a company that, they've been profitable, expected to be profitable, used to be viewed as one of the better in the industry. So to buy a pretty good management team with good properties, it does, clearly the analysts are going to be wrong, but they're still expecting this company to make pretty good money. It'd be, say, 13 times future earnings. That's not likely to happen, I guess, but you don't expect a company that's well-run with a lot of great resources and okay balance sheet and is profitable to be dropping every single day. So, we own about as much as we can of this one, and we're happy to hold it. We believe it'll probably make us a lot of money, but maybe the market's telling us something. We like it a lot. And energy in general, when people hated oil and it was 28, we bought oil. Now oil's doubled and gas is on its ass. Now we like gas better. To your question on coal, 3-4 years back, coal became about as cheap and hated as anything you'll ever see in your life. We did some things right and some things wrong. We bought at the bottom and had companies like Consol that went up 3 times in a couple months. Some of the other smaller ones did pretty well. So we did that right. What we did wrong was we invested in Peabody, whose management team had different ethics than we would have liked to see, and that didn't work out well for us. And we've had another one that had a flooding problem. So we haven't done as well as we could have done on coal, but we certainly were able to take advantage when it got way too cheap. Now, in the future, solar and wind will be growth, and gas will be growth, and oil's pretty much not in the electricity business anymore. And I think in the developed world, you won't see much in the way of nuclear coming on, and there won't be a lot of other hydroelectric dams being built. So I think in the emerging markets, you'll see all of it. You'll see solar and wind and nuclear and some hydro and even coal. Some of them are still building coal. Some of the more polluted places like China, you'll probably see a reduction of coal. And the rest of the world, I think it's solar, wind, and gas. We don't particularly like coal, but at a price, we'll buy anything.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question from John Friesen.
Hey, David. I was reading a research report on Turquoise Hill, and I wanted to share something with you. The analyst is implying a downside scenario of 17%, a base price target of 233% higher, and a upside scenario of 4X. Would you agree with me that that implies limited downside with a tremendous amount of upside? And I guess the funniest thing about the article is it basically says all the bad news is likely priced, and then they've got a sector perform rating on it. And so I was curious with you is what's the turning point in your investing life where you see these assets that people hate, and then they almost begrudgingly acknowledge that this asset's cheap, and we think there's a lot of upside, but we still don't want to recommend anybody to invest in it. So I'm curious for your thoughts on Turquoise Hill, if you agree with that scenario analysis, and then just anecdotally, what's the turning point?
Yeah, I mean, first the concept and the specifics concept, we absolutely agree with you. We like it in an otherwise overvalued market. There are a lot of companies kind of similar to Turquoise Hill where you talk to people, they know the price is going to go up 2, 3, 4 times. But they have a neutral on it because they don't think it's going to happen in the near term. And so, one point is the chart we always show on IRR. If Turquoise Hill goes up 4 times, it doesn't matter if we have to wait 2 years. It doesn't matter if we have to wait 12 years. We're going to make a lot of money on that. And you probably won't have to. So we have a whole portfolio of, sort of free options. Companies that are so cheap, we probably don't lose much if we're wrong, and we make 4X if we're right. So this is a market that, like I said, they're giving away assets, even as they pay more than infinity for bonds. And so we really, really like that. And, of course, we agree with you that Turquoise Hill has a lot more upside than it does downside. Now, specifically with Turquoise Hill, let's break it into the two parts. One was the idea that they pushed back the production a couple quarters. We actually don't mind that at all. You know, one of the interesting things in the market, if people are looking at almost anything that's not a resource business, they do a DCF and they assume earnings grow by 12% a year and they discount it back at 10 and they say, look how much it's worth. But when they, when they're doing resources, they tend to assume the price stays flat or goes down. Gold, they assume it goes way down. And then they discount that at 10% a year, which effectively means something that you're not going to pull out of the ground for 5 to 10 years is worthless or close to worthless. Fine. If their scenarios are right, I guess that's true. However, let's say that, you know, some commodities have to get up to that incentive price that will incentivize enough supply to balance demand. And if copper will quite likely have to go up 50%, but we don't know when, and uranium's got to go up 200%, we don't know when, and gas will probably go up 3 times, and we don't know when, then it becomes more of an option. You don't want to sell something now when the price is going to go up 50 to 200%. Options, the opposite of a DCF model, an option becomes worth more when you have more time for things to work out for you. And so it's actually good that Turquoise Hill is not going to be selling copper at 2-something when they can sell it at 4-something in the future. So the optionality part is good. We have proof of that. Now, the second part they announced recently was not good. You know, the block caving is very difficult, and people fear it. And, of course, they're in West Rio Tinto is a very good company, and they've gone in there and said, we like the fact that this is soft mineralization, perfect for block caving. But they got down there, and they say, all right, the fault lines are different than we thought. And so we either need to shore it up more or we need to come in from a different angle. And so instead of $5 billion, maybe it's $6.5 billion, plus or minus. Well, that means this company is worth $1.5 billion less than we thought it was worth before. That's so that we're not thrilled with. I had a one-on-one meeting with their CEO 2 days ago. It's very interesting, but no, it's not good. However, we subtract that $1.5 billion, and we still concur with what you said and what that analysis did. We think it's more than 4 times upside. We see a lot of upside after the bad news. So we're a huge fan of companies that have that kind of upside and are good companies. That, you know, that's, it would be the second or third largest copper company in the world. Like I say, they're partners with Rio Tinto. Rio Tinto and BHP are the two premier companies in the world in the industry. So it's really a wonderful situation with some unfortunate cost overruns.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my question.
We'll take our next question from Andrea Zilli.
Hey, Dave. Thank you for taking the time. Appreciate it. Would you mind commenting on the opportunity that you're seeing or not seeing in Europe, specifically when it, as it regards to banks?
Certainly. So, you know, we, as a firm, I have mentioned we risk adjust everything. We want discounts on everything we buy. and we want bigger discounts for things like technology because they become obsolete so fast, and we like bigger discounts on things like retail because of the weak barriers to entry, and we've always liked big discounts on banks because they're levered 90% plus minus. So we've tended to want really big discounts, and because we want really big discounts, we owned no financials in 2005, 6, 7, 8, 9, then late 9, 2010, 11, we were able to buy a lot of dominant emerging market banks and those sort of things, and it worked out. But we generally haven't owned a whole lot. You know, we do still have spare bank. But to your point, the banks in Europe are now at very big discounts. And so, you know, whether to own some of them, it's possible. Our bank analyst is looking at various banks in Europe, Korea, Japan, places like that, where they are getting big discounts. As long as we're able to get more than compensated from the risk that that leverage brings, we're happy to look at it. So it's possible. Good question.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question from Bruce Daigle.
Well, Dave, thanks for this conference call. It's always helpful. My question was on Turquoise Hill, but thanks for answering that. That was really what I wanted to know. But now that I've got you, can you chat just a little bit about what you think the agricultural sector is going to look like? Are you interested at all in the soft commodities and fertilizers?
Certainly. We, as I mentioned, it's interesting that people will pay up for industries that are likely to be disrupted, and they're bored with things like agriculture. But, yeah, we think we're probably all still likely to eat corn and beef and things like that in the future. Yeah, we used to talk, I guess it's getting there again, Chipotle, what people will pay for a burrito, and yet we, for five times earnings, we can buy the stuff that's in the burrito. And so over time, we've owned fertilizer companies, we've owned tractor companies and irrigation companies and food companies. The best values we're finding now are the people actually growing the stuff. And over the last two or three years, we've been able actually to take advantage of, you know, we get a bargain in Brazil, and then that runs up, and we get a bargain in Argentina, and that runs up, and we get a bargain in Ukraine, and that runs up, and we'll get a bargain in Indonesia. And so for companies that are five times earnings, give or take, and are valued on a price per acre of land at, you know, sometimes 90% cheaper than it would cost in the U.S. Midwest, that's pretty interesting to us. We have one of the biggest chicken producers in Europe. They're based in the Ukraine. We have also in the Ukraine a sugar beet farmer and a sunflower seed grower and processor and owner of a port. We have a ag company in Brazil. We used to have one that ran up. We sold. We have another one that actually gets the farm ready and sells it off. They've done pretty well. We've got a coconut oil, producer in Indonesia that hasn't done that well, but it's done a lot better this year. And so that's where we find the most value. But, you know, maybe someday back in fertilizer equipment, because farming is not going away. So we concur.
Thank you. Have a great quarter. I think it's going to be an exciting one for you.
It should be. Thank you.
And that concludes the question and answer session. I'd like to turn the call back over to Dave.
All right. Well, thank you all for calling in. as we just heard, it's likely to be an interesting quarter, certainly an interesting year, and certain massive bifurcations in the market. So thanks for calling, and we'll talk to you all again in a quarter. Bye.
Thank you.
That concludes the conference. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.